What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, and as always, remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow, where for just $1 a month, you can help make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you'll qualify for great bonus content, including alternative podcast feed and rarely seen clips that aired on our live shows.
Oh, welcome, 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 friends. My name is Roz Pachesky. It's my honor to welcome you to this conversation with Professor Rashid Khalidi and the wonderful Katie Helper. Probably many of you have read his majestic The Hundred Years' War on Palestine. It's been required reading among JVP's cohorts and study groups this past year. But maybe you didn't know, I didn't, that The Hundred Years' War has been among the top five of the New York Times nonfiction bestseller list for around 8 months. Yes. You can clap. It's well deserved. So I hand the discussion over to Katie and Rashid. Please take your seats.
Now should be. Hello? Is this thing on? Okay, great. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you so much to the People's Forum. Thank you so much to Roz and to everyone at JVP, at Jewish Voice for Peace, who's helped. Oh, I see some Kinderlanders. Hello. And of course, thank you so much, Professor Khalidi, for being here. We have so much to talk about. I know people in the audience have tons of questions, I'm sure. And we're going to get to them after I monopolize your time for a little bit. And we're going to talk about the awful things that are happening right now as we speak. But I want to start off by talking about your great book, which many have said is the most important book for understanding what is happening right now as we speak in Palestine. So your book is extremely accessible, and it's less academic than other works of yours, and it includes a lot of personal story about your family. What made you decide to write this book in a more accessible way? I kind of know the answer, but I want others to know.
Yeah, no, let me give you the answer. I like this question.
Yeah, good.
I had, as you say, I'd written a number of books that were more academic. And I kept getting harassed by my son and by a couple of other family members who said, enough already with books that only PhDs can read. Write something that normal people can read, that's accessible, and include some of the stuff that you talk about to us. You know, your uncle this, your aunt that, your grandmother and the other kinds of things, and your own personal experiences. And so under, you know, the constant whiplash, if any of you have older children, you'll know what I'm talking about. The constant whiplash of especially my son, but my kids generally, and a couple of other family members, I decided to do what they said. And I was very fortunate in having a very good editor, Reva Hockerman, and a very good agent, both of whom read, together with my son, read and reread and took out all of the things that they said really were going to hinder this book from reaching, you know, a large audience. And by God, they were right. That's how it came to be written. I basically sat down and didn't just try and write boring history. I tried to tell stories that came out of my own experience, my family's experience, the books, the memoirs, the personal things that I knew about. And I tried to, even though it had a very, I hope, you know, solid backbone of fact and history, 45 pages of footnotes. You can read it without looking at any of the footnotes because there's some stories there. And so I hope it worked.
Yeah, I think it did. And did you get any pushback for including more personal stories?
On the contrary.
Okay.
No. I mean, it kept being pushed by, again, my son, one of my cousins, my editor, and my agent, more.
But what about in academia?
I don't care.
Okay. I mean, I would hope you did.
Why
right?
would
That'd
I care?
That'd be a good sign.
I mean, I've written seven other books. If they want to read, you know, boring, yeah. dry, factual, right. whatever, they can go to those.
Yeah.
I don't know. I got no pushback whatsoever.
Okay. Yeah. Great. So you're obviously a historian, but you are not shy about having, I would say, political convictions. And in fact, Roz just mentioned that you were very outspoken on campus at Columbia. If you don't mind, I want to show a pretty moving, I think, intervention of yours when you're speaking on campus to give everyone a sense of how you are both a historian and I don't know if you call yourself an activist, but certainly someone who engages in the politics of the world. So we're going to show this and then I'm going to ask you some questions about it.
Oh, that, yes.
Yeah.
That was outside of the campus. We couldn't get onto the
right.
campus. We were locked out. The Vietnam War stopped because the people opposed it. And the people who led that were students. Students have been on the right side of history at Columbia and at other universities ever since the 1960s. We today honor the students who in 1968 opposed a genocidal, illegal, shameful war. Columbia University honors them. They're on the Columbia website. You can check it out yourself. 1968 is commemorated. One day, what our students did here will be commemorated in the same way.
Yeah! Yeah!
They are and they were on the right side of history. And that will go down in history. That when the change finally came, and finally the American people who have already opposed this war, who have already opposed this genocide, are able to force their craven politicians to stop it, which we can do. The United States is part of this war. Every plane bombing Gaza is an American plane, F-16s, F-15s, F-35s. Every helicopter, Apache, is American. Every bomb drop is American. Those are our taxes. Those are our representatives.
Shame
on them. And shame on the administration of this university. They will go down in infamy for having done what they did the other night. Today, nobody remembers the names of the administrators and the trustees who ordered the police onto the Columbia campus on 1968. They have gone down in ignominy. So will these leaders, President Shafiq and the Board of Trustees. And the students will be remembered one day on a Columbia website as the people who helped change the course of this country.
Wow. You haven't seen it? Oh, wow. It's great. It's very moving, very, very inspiring. So what is the relationship between being a historian and also someone who engages in the real world outside of academia? And of course, your mentor, Edward Said, talks about permission to narrate. So history in itself as a discipline can be very disruptive and subversive and a question of power and control. So how do you see those two roles?
Well, I mean, there are things that I do in my private life that have nothing to do with my role as a professor. I'm retired now, but when I was a professor. Political work, certain kinds of activism, that speech. But I personally think, and I have long thought, that for those very few people in academia who have the privilege of tenure and therefore have some protection against being fired, though they are firing people with tenure right. now,
yeah.
on this issue.
More Finkelstein.
Rarely happens on other issues. On this issue, people are threatened. But if you have that protection, it is shameful if you don't use it to at least push the envelope to at least challenge some of these falsehoods that, you know, populate the universe of discourse. And so I've always felt that it was my job as a historian, as a teacher, to do as much as I could in that direction. And also to animate my activism and my political work and my media work and so forth with what I've learned and what I teach. They're different registers, if you want. I mean, what I said in the classroom this morning is not the kind of thing that I'm going to be saying tonight. But I hope that they're both inspired by a desire to push the envelope, force people to face things that they're not normally able or willing or allowed to face.
And you say in the end of your intro, it is my hope that this book will reflect this resilience of the Palestinian people and help recover some of what has thus far been airbrushed out of the history by those who control all of historic Palestine and the narrative surrounding it. So you're obviously someone who is steeped in the history of Palestine as an historian of the Middle East, and also as an historian who writes on colonialism, and personally you are as well. I'm just curious, because your book is considered so seminal for so many people and so enlightening, what were the most surprising things that you discovered yourself while working on this book?
You know, most of what's in this book, it covers things that I've written about before. Not all of it. Most of it. What I've been most surprised by was not actually what I discovered as I was writing the book. It's what I've discovered since the book was published. The reactions have been phenomenal. I mean, I have never had a response to anything I've written or done or said in my life, and I've been at it for decades and decades and decades. To compare with the kinds of, especially emails that I get from people whose whole view of things has apparently been changed from what they say to me by reading this book. And that has moved me, but it surprised me and pleased me. I mean, there are many things that I realized as I was writing the book that I put together and I synthesized that I never actually had the sense to see before, that I, you know, worked on or thought about. I've been researching British policy since I was an undergraduate in the Middle East. So there I knew a whole lot about it. As I wrote this book, I realized things that I had never realized before. If you want to understand colonialism, you have to go to the colonizer's archive. And that's one of the things I've been doing since I was a graduate student. And some of it clicked as I wrote this book, I think. The same thing is true with other things about Palestinian history, about which I'd written at least two or three other books before this.
And what about things about your family? Were you surprised to learn anything?
Not really. No. I did some research at the beginning. For example, the first chapter, the stuff about Yusuf Diaz's letter to Theodor Herzl. One of my ancestors, a great-great-great-uncle, wrote a letter to Theodor Herzl in 1899, which, in my view, summarizes the entire situation, that and Herzl's response. And I had read them briefly before, but I never really thought about them the way that I did. And I realized, start a book with this. I mean, this tells the whole story in two letters. So yes, there were a lot of things that I realized. I mean, again, I looked at one of my uncles had written a memoir. I had read it so casually, quickly. I'd introduced the book at a book fair in Amman, but I had never thought about it in the same way as I did when I was writing this book.
So I actually have some of that letter from your great-great-great-uncle. I heard you say kind of under your breath during an interview, I think he wasn't that great, actually.
No, not that many greats.
Oh,
no, he was quite okay. A character. No,
got
no.
Got it. Okay, you weren't throwing him under
the
bus.
I was not
okay.
Trying to throw any shade on my great-great-great-uncle.
Okay. No shade.
I think the interviewer said four or five greats.
And I see. Right. Got it. Yeah.
Too many greats.
Too many greats. Oh, okay, got it. So that's what you meant. Okay, not that great. Okay, got it. So your great-great-great-uncle, Yusuf, said to Herzl, to whom he wrote through an intermediary, I believe, he called Herzl a writer of talent and a true Jewish patriot. He called Jews our cousins, speaking, of course, of the relationship between Jews and Muslims. He called Zionist aspirations, quote, natural, beautiful, and just. Who could contest the rights of the Jews in Palestine? My God, historically, it is your country, end quote. But don't take that out of context, anyone. Because he also wrote, nothing could be more just and equitable than for the, quote, unhappy Jewish nation, end quote, to find refuge. But he also wrote, in the name of God, let Palestine be left alone. So I thought that this was fascinating, and we can get into Herzl's response. But what I found so interesting about this letter is that it encapsulates this simultaneous empathy and fear that your ancestor had. And he understands Zionism, this political project, as both something that I guess for which he has sympathy to a certain extent, but he also recognizes it as a dangerous project. And I know that speaking personally, I was not raised Zionist, but something I struggled with as a younger person was how can Israel be this bad colonial power, which I knew it was, but how is it both a bad colonial power and also the place that people fled the Holocaust to get to? Can you talk about that tension and how they actually coexist?
Yeah, let me start talking about Yusuf Zia al-Khaldi, because he had studied in Vienna and he had taught in Vienna. Vienna had as its mayor a man named Karl Liger, a fanatic anti-Semite, one of the inspirers of Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler idolized him. And so he was deeply steeped in and studied. I mean, we have his books in the family library in Jerusalem. He had studied Zionism. He studied Judaism. He understood the connection between the Jewish people and Palestine, the Holy Land. He understood anti-Semitism. We have the Austrian papers that he got in Jerusalem. So he was reading about the Zionist Congress in Basel and all that stuff. He knew a great deal about not just the persecution, but the connection to the Holy Land, so on and so forth. At the same time, he understood what Herzl was trying to do. He had probably read Der Judenstaat, the State of the Jews, the book that he wrote, Herzl had written. And he knew about what the Zionist movement was trying to do. And so he said, yes, there's a Jewish people, and yes, they're persecuted, and yes, nothing would be more beautiful than their having a refuge, but not here. And so he had been mayor of Jerusalem. He had represented Jerusalem in the Ottoman parliament. He understood what this would do to his own people. And so I think the two come together in that letter, as I think you clearly showed in the bits that you read from the book.
And so what does that reveal about the relationship between Israel as a settler colonial predator and also Israel as a place that, as you said yourself, some Holocaust survivors were forced to go to precisely because the great powers that then claimed to be motivated by altruism and guilt would not let them in?
I mean, this is one of those can you walk and chew gum at the same time situations. Yes, Zionism arises out of the response of people suffering from persecution to a situation that to them is intolerable. And this is the solution that they choose. Most people in the Eastern European ghettos didn't choose that. Most of them came here or to other places of refuge or tried to stay and change their societies. But for a tiny minority at the time, Zionism was the only way out of these ghettos, of this persecution, of this anti-Semitism, of these pogroms. This is happening at the time of rising anti-Semitism in the Russian Empire, which is where most of the immigrants to Palestine actually came from. Most of the signatories of Israel's Declaration of Independence come from about 150 miles from Kyiv, in what's today Belarus, Ukraine, and Russia. In other words, from the Russian Empire. And those people were the most persecuted people in the entirety of Europe, among all the Jewish population. He understood that. He knew that. And he understood that Zionism was seen as a refuge. At the same time, he saw that Herzl was going around to the great powers to get their patronage. He tried the Russian Tsar. He tried the German Kaiser. He tried the French Republic. Later on, Weizmann succeeded with the Brits. He tried the Ottoman Sultan. He knew, because he spent part of his time in Istanbul, that the Zionists were trying to get external support for settlement in Palestine with the aim not of living there as a minority, taking the country over. And so he saw that on the one hand, this was, in a sense, a just cause or just idea, but its implementation would produce this injustice. Whence the statement that you read, for the sake of God, leave Palestine alone.
Right. It's interesting. I was even uncomfortable. I kind of debated whether to ask you about this because I feel, and I assume a lot of other members of Jewish Voice for Peace may feel this way, but sometimes I'm anathema to even thinking about Jewish, like privileging Jewish feelings about safety, because that is so used to eclipse all Palestinian safety and literally life, right? It's used to justify the eradication of Palestinians. But I also am very aware of something that you've described as a discursive war. And I actually want to ask you kind of, well, first of all, if you could elaborate on what you mean by discursive war. And then if you have any tips for the Jews who are here tonight about how we can be good soldiers in this discursive war.
I mean, look, I'm at an event organized by Jewish Voice for Peace, who are the most accomplished people in this field in this country's history. So I have no lessons to teach Roz and her comrades. They're doing a fantastic job. They don't need any advice from me. So I'm not going to answer that part of your question. But about your point about feeling, I take your point. And I think that, you know, most of us are not passionate nationalists. And people who feel a revulsion from Zionism, not so much because of war crimes or genocide or settler colonialism, but because they don't feel that nationalistic. I mean, you know, I bet most people here don't have American flags outside their apartments. Okay, there you are. We're Americans, most people here, but we're not that kind of flag-waving Americans. And I think that there is that in many people's reaction to Zionism. But the refuge element of it, which is part of it, I mean, Zionism is a settler colonial project. It's a project to secure refuge for persecuted populations, especially in Eastern Europe. And it has multiple other characteristics. It's an ally. It's always been, from the moment that Herzl starts the project, an ally of great imperial powers. Okay? So you're on the side of the colonizer, you're on the side of the imperialist, or you're on the side of the colonized. And Herzl and Weizmann and Ben-Gurion, they all made their choice. They stood on one side. So that's another aspect of it. It didn't necessarily have to be that way, but that is the way it developed. Now, there are people like the Brit Shalom group in Palestine in the 1930s, Geshem Shalom and so on and so forth, Judah Magnus, I could go on. These are Einstein, Hannah Arendt, people. I mean, these are more eminent than any of the political leaders I've talked about, much greater minds than the Ben-Gurions and the Weizmanns and so on. But they were not the majority. The majority were people who believed in you had to use force in order to establish this because we're driven in the... And you know the rest of the argument. The problem is they didn't see or didn't want to see what they were doing. And this is what Yusuf Leah Cheldi is trying to do in 1899. See what you are going to do. And you read Herzl's response. He didn't want to see. And with the very few exceptions... Most Zionist and now Israeli leaders don't want to see. They refuse, and they refuse to allow us to see, more importantly, once the discursive element. Because another thing that this project is a fantastic, I don't know what you'd call it, Hasbara project. I mean, the propaganda, public diplomacy, call it what you want. There was an economic and a military and all of these other elements. This was among the paramount elements. Look at some of the leaders. Golda. She spoke brilliantly. I heard her speak once. I've heard her in the Security Council. I heard her on TV, but I actually sat there and listened to her. Abba Iban. These are eloquent people. And these are people who become leaders of the Zionist project, not because they know how to handle a gun, though Abba Iban had been an officer in the British Army, but because they were eloquent and able to put the case. They understood the importance of this. And that's where I get to this idea of discursive. It was being fought in the West on this discursive level because they understood without support from this Western metropole, Britain initially, other countries, and eventually the United States, ultimately, you couldn't do what they were trying to do to establish this Jewish state in an overwhelmingly Arab country.
So again, I promise I won't ask you too many times about the orders that I'm asking you for in this discursive war. But is it useful? I guess just returning to that tension again, is it useful, do you think, for certain Jews to speak to the Jews who have been brainwashed by Hasbara and say to them, no, this whole Holocaust thing, okay, that sounds like I'm a Holocaust denier or something. Okay, no, the weaponization of the Holocaust, or even the founders of Israel did not primarily care about survivors. I mean, this is something I just learned working on this new documentary about survivors speaking out on genocide.
Tom Segev has a wonderful book about this.
Yeah. 7th Million, right? Is that, exactly. Yeah. Is that we all know how much Israel weaponizes the Holocaust now and anti-Semitism, but they mistreated them horribly. How much should, and this is a huge question, but is it helpful for non-Jews if Jews tell other Jews certain things like, no, this was not a project just to save Jews, or no, this was not about making a safe space for Jews and also letting the people there exist? Like, in other words, how much should we respond to the Hasbara and how much should we ignore it? I guess that's one of my questions.
I mean, I've always believed, and I believed it more and more as time went on, that on some of these issues, only anti-Zionist or non-Zionist Jews have any credibility speaking to certain publics, not just Jewish publics, also, you know, Christian or whatever, Hindu, whatever publics. I'll tell you a little story. I got to know Itamar Rabinovich, who was the chancellor of Tel Aviv University, U.S. Israeli ambassador to the United States, when I was in charge of an exchange program at the University of Chicago, and he was the person who dealt with it from the Israeli side. So I got to know him when he was ambassador, and I was an advisor to the Palestinian delegation in the negotiations in Washington. He headed the Israeli delegation negotiating with the Syrians, and he came that close to a peace treaty with Syria. And at one stage, he came to Chicago as ambassador to publicize the peace talks and how close they were. And he got together a bunch of people who were supposedly Middle East experts. And I was with Itamar, literally the only Middle East expert in the room. The other people were tax lawyers and business professors and proctologists and whatever, all of whom believed fervently in Israel and knew a great deal about Israel and knew nothing about anything else.
I'll resist the proctology joke. Okay.
You should probably. As far as the Middle East was concerned. And he starts talking in his, you know, he's a former colonel in the Army military intelligence, big man, imposing, charismatic, you know, what you expect from an Israeli officer, an ambassador. And he was very convincing because I knew they were really getting close to a deal with the Syrians. And the people in the audience, it wasn't an audience, it was 12, 15 people around the table, started objecting. The Syrians will never, and how can you deal with them? They're monsters. And they went on and on. And at one point, Itamar turns to me and he says, "You tell them." I said, "They're not going to believe me. This is the result of decades of propaganda that your government has planted in these poor people's minds. And you know more." He wrote the book on the Syrian bath. I mean, the man actually knew Syria intimately. He used the captured Syrian Ba'ath Party files in Quneitra to write a book. And he was Israel's top expert on Syria, and he was Israel's top negotiator with the Syrians. He had the confidence of the Israeli prime minister, Rabin, and they played tennis together. That's how close they were. And he knew what he was talking about, and these people would not believe him. So obviously, if Rabinovich wasn't believed by them because of the brainwashing, they weren't going to believe me. But I would argue that, just to come back to the answer to your question, yes, it is essential that people who have become enlightened and have understood the situation in Palestine and Israel speak to those kinds of audiences. There's a credibility there, especially from people who have really educated themselves, that I can't even have with certain audiences. I used to try that. I spoke a lot to, you know, mixed groups and to Jewish groups and synagogues. Nobody invites me anymore to those kinds of
Mazel
things.
Tov.
Yeah, no. Yeah. I'm not crying salt right. tears. But the point is, I can't even address those kinds of audiences. And so, yes, I think it's incumbent on people. And that's one reason I value JVP.
Yeah. Those of you who roll your eyes, try to power through it for the cause once and speak to your annoying relatives. You like to say, understandably, that your job description does not include predicting the future, does not involve a crystal ball. That's not a crystal ball, just a glass. But as a historian, how do present-day actions, if at all, shape the way we understand the past? And for instance, with October 7th, does October 7th change the way you see history? Does it make you think, oh, I got that wrong in this book or any other book? And how does it change the way you see the present moment?
There's several questions there. I do actually think history helps us to understand the present a lot. And if you don't understand history and context and background, you're just dumb in understanding the present. There's no way you can understand what's going on. I firmly believe that.
Like that history started on October 7th?
Yeah, for example, yeah. Or history started in 1948 or 1967 or any arbitrary date. I mean, I take 1917, but I have a good argument for it.
Yes.
In the book. The problem with looking at October 7th today, at the end of October 2024, is that we're still in the middle of a war. And every time I get asked a question about, you know, how do you assess October 7th, it's like saying, how do I assess September 1939 in 1941? The war's still on. we really don't know how this is going to end up. 3 days ago, 5 days ago, 6 weeks ago, you had leaders of Hezbollah and leaders of Hamas being knocked off one by one. You had the Israeli military entering Lebanon for the first time since 2006. You had various things that made it look like Israel was doing fantastically well. Today, you read the body counts, and you read in Haaretz, 12,000 Israeli soldiers have been wounded since October 7th, and you read that this is beginning to impact Israeli public opinion. And that's what it looks like on the 29th of October. It may look completely differently in November. So I wouldn't even begin to assess how I did it. And some things I wrote right after the war began, I said, this is really important. But that was pretty easy to say. Yeah. That was obvious. Where it's going to end up and how it will affect the future, only God knows. I wouldn't even dream of trying to assess it. Maybe when the fighting stops, if it stops. I mean, nothing seems to be capable of stopping it at the moment. But when it stops, if it stops, it'll be a little easier to do an assessment. And then to try and predict, for those who want to try and predict, what that might mean for the future. But I won't be one of them.
You've said that Israel's behavior is suicidal. And in an interview with Tariq Ali at the New Left Review, you said that it's both futile and harmful, futile and harmful to American interests. So why is Israel doing what it's doing, and why is the United States enabling it and participating in it?
Yeah. Why Israel is doing what it's doing is an easier question to answer. Israel is doing what it's doing because, first of all, that's the logic of settler colonialism. If you don't hold the native down, the native will overwhelm you. And so force, and then if force doesn't work, more force is almost the only Israeli answer to this. Now, there have been some Israeli leaders who've been able to see beyond that. Rabin did, but didn't go far enough. You might argue that Barak and Olmert, I'm not a fan of either. At least very feebly tried to break out of that paradigm. But that's been the paradigm since the beginning, really. You don't overcome an indigenous population with roses, because the indigenous population, as Jabotinsky kept saying, is going to resist you. They understand what you're here to do, and they're not going to lie down and let you walk over them. So you either eliminate them utterly, or you expel them totally, or you're going to be fighting with them forever. And actually, Dayan said that in that famous speech that he gave right outside of Gaza in the early 50s. He said, we're going to have to fight forever. And so that when you have that logic, you just fight, and you fight, and you fight. And I think that Netanyahu brilliantly sums up that. I mean, he is an heir of Jabotinsky, in a sense. His father was Jabotinsky's secretary for a brief period. And he has that worldview much more deeply than any previous Israeli prime minister. So I think Israel is pretty easy to understand. You don't see any willingness on the part of this generation of Israeli leaders, from the so-called left to the right, or the far right to the right, which is the Israeli political spectrum, to offer anything at all but the sword. And if you don't like the sword, more sword. And if not, you don't like bayonet, and then whatever. Now, the United States is a harder question. And just to finish up with the suicidal thing, I think anybody who takes Israel into Gaza without an end game for getting out is suicidal, is a masochist. Anyone who takes Israel into Lebanon without a plan to get out is even worse. I mean, Gaza, you can kill indefinitely people because they're hemmed in. You have them under your total control. You've had them under your total control for decades. But Lebanon? Lebanon has a hinterland to the entire world. You cannot seal it off. And you are fighting in extremely unfavorable terrain. I mean, they're losing 3, 4, 5 guys a week, 6, 10 guys killed, and dozens wounded, 12,000 wounded in a year. And the rate this month was the highest death toll for the Israeli army of any month in the war. This is the genius of putting your army into Lebanon and Gaza at the same time. Suicidal. I don't think there's any other. And the smart people in the former military officers, you can read them in Haaretz or Yediot. They're saying the same thing I'm saying. It's not a particularly original view.
So is that because, for instance, I mean, it's suicidal on the part of some and maybe homicidal on the part of the people.
It's homicidal for sure.
Right. No, we know it. Sorry. Yes, it's 100% homicidal towards of Palestinians. But in terms of the suicidal nature of it, is it this weird, I mean, I don't know how to bring the metaphor totally around, but it's suicidal, let's say, for the soldiers doing it, but for the higher ups who aren't.
It's suicidal for the project. I'm not just talking about casualties. I'm talking what this is doing to the image of Israel, what this is doing to Israel's place in the world, what this is doing to Israel's support among communities that were supportive. I mean, public opinion has turned against Israel in the countries which have been its metropole since the beginning. It starts in Switzerland. It starts in Austria. It starts in Western Europe. It starts in the United States. You have people raising money here in the 20s, 30s, 40s. That support is eroding. Majorities of Americans oppose this war. Majorities of Americans oppose sending weapons to Israel. It's been the case for 6 months, thanks to what they're doing. It wasn't the genius of Palestinian public diplomacy that brought people around. It was what Israel was doing. So in that sense, it's to my way of thinking, it may prove to be fatal for the project. I mean, I don't know. I'm not going to predict.
Right.
But it certainly looks like they've done enormous damage to themselves. And I don't just talk about 12,000 people maimed and blinded and so on. I'm talking about what it's doing to Israel and to the project, the Zionist project. American policy is a much harder question for me. I can see an interest which goes back to what, what's her name, Irene Genzier discovered in looking at 1948, that people in the American military, who are a little bit like the Israeli military in some respects, they love force and they respect only force. They saw in the Israeli army as early as 1948 this extraordinarily competent instrument. Now, the problem with an instrument is you have to have a brain to use it. And up until the present, I would argue Israeli leaders have used that instrument fairly intelligently. They've ceased to do so in recent years. But the American military has a respect for that. I mean, you can read the Journal of the Naval Institute, an assessment by a pilot, an F-18 pilot, a Navy pilot, of the attack on that killed Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah in Beirut, in the southern suburbs. And he talks, it's almost erotic, about the way they dropped bombs. They dropped X number of bombs on each corner of each of these buildings. And then they had a bomb that exploded. The article is almost orgasmic. So you have that love and respect for anybody who can do what they didn't lose a single plane over Iran. I mean, that's amazing from a purely technical point of view. It's stupid politically, but that's not what the military is looking at. So that's one element of it. And then you have the military-industrial complex. I mean, that $17 billion went straight into the pockets of Raytheon and General Dynamics and so forth. I mean, these guys own half of our politicians, these industries. They're ecstatic. So there's another element. Israel goes to war, we make money. And then finally, you have a politician in our president who, I mean, leaving aside his various deficiencies, current deficiencies, I'm speaking as diplomatically as I can. Is a deep-dyed believer in Israel is always right. I mean, he's always believed this. He was proselytized by Golda herself. And she was a very, very persuasive woman. Read, what's his name's biography of her? Is it Segev? No. There's a new biography of her, a really good biography of her. And she was a spellbinding figure. You look at her picture and say, she doesn't really look very impressive, but she was enormously impressive, enormously impressive. She worked on him. She was the first person to work on him. And he's been, you know, under that kind of, also check it out. Type in Joe Biden AIPAC money. And he is the largest single recipient of money from AIPAC and Israel-related lobbies in American history from 1990 until today.
Wow.
I'm sure that had nothing to do with his views. But, you know, you have a president who's chosen people around him who obviously reflect his views, which are troglodyte views. I mean, they're views that formed in the 1960s where Israel was a miracle, made the desert bloom. It's perfect. And he believes that. He literally believes, not only believes everything they say, he repeats everything they say. Admiral Daniel Hagari, the spokesman, has said very few things that Joe Biden has not actually repeated word for word. And if he didn't repeat it, the hacks who speak for him, Admiral Kirby and these other folks, repeated them. So, and they're you know, they're master's voice. They're repeating what Biden wants repeated. So you have people who basically believe Israel can do no wrong in the White House.
That's my fear and why I was kind of questioning the suicidal nature of Israel, because, I mean, fingers crossed, it does end that project, right? And maybe it's going to take a long time. But my fear is that given the unending, undying support of the West, it doesn't matter about, I mean, it does to some extent, how much does public opinion shift matter?
I want to correct something you just said, because the undying support of the Western elites.
Yes, political and media.
Is one
elites,
thing.
Yes, yeah.
The undying support of the West is another thing. If you go back to Woodrow Wilson, or you go back to Balfour, in other words, post-World War I, the idea of Zionism had the support of Western publics.
Right.
It didn't just have the support of elites. And there are different reasons for that. It's not important. And that was true from the beginning of Zionism, I would argue, or soon after, right up until quite recently, a decade or two ago. You had public opinion supportive of Israel. I mean, every poll I've ever seen said that. It's not true anymore, but it was true up until a few years ago. And it still is true for people my age and 20 years younger than me. Overwhelming support for Israel among much older people. That's changing with the younger generation. So Israel no longer has the support of the West. If you by that you mean the people in these supposed democracies. If you mean the wall-to-wall elites, yes, that has not changed. One bit.
Right.
There you're right.
I know that people, I mean, to keep hope personally, I look and I see the public opinion shift. And I see it not having an immediate impact on our elites. But then I think, well, historically, you're never going to have the shift at the elite level without this stuff happening right at the bottom.
Well, I'm going to make two parallels or a couple parallels that are not really terribly accurate, but I'm going to make them anyway. Think about how the anti-war movement in the 60s eventually changed public opinion. I mean, body bags and mainstream media being allowed on the battlefield, which the army eventually stopped allowing, changed public opinion. And it was overwhelmingly anti-war long before either the Johnson administration or the Nixon administration stopped the war. It took the better part of a decade from the beginning of the shift in public opinion to the end of the war in 75. Same was true with the Iraq War. Bush was reelected in 04 with a majority of the popular vote, because up to that point, the war was popular. If you look at public opinion polls, literally for the months after November 9, 2004, support for the war declines. And the war went on for another 7 years or six, depending on how you count it. I'm talking about the Iraq War. So it takes a long time before the people can force their rulers to change the policies that they're bent on. And I would argue this is going to be even harder in many ways. We do not have a draft. American soldiers are not fighting. They're involved, but they're not fighting. They're involved intimately in targeting, in tracking, in intelligence, in air defense, in many things. Their American military presence is involved in the war, but they're not boots on the ground doing the actual combat. And you, so that's one factor you cannot look at when you compare to Vietnam or Iraq.
Right.
And there are others, obviously.
There's a kind of wag the dog debate that, to oversimplify, I'll just say is, on the one hand, you have the Mearsheimer thesis, which is that it's the Israel lobby controlling the United States and forces it to act against its own interests. And then you have the other, I mean, Chomskyan or many other people say it's the United States using Israel as a pawn for its own national interests. So where do you fall on that?
I have argued very extensively in several books that I've written that when American leaders deduce that there is something that Israel is doing that is not in the American national interest, they force Israel to do what they want. Obama did that with the nuclear deal with Iran. And Netanyahu spoke twice before joint sessions of Congress to try and derail what the president was doing or had done. And he failed. It was decided, I can tell you what the military thinks. The military thinks the United States cannot win a war with Iran. And so they said, what are our alternatives? Let's take the deal. It was a great deal. Should have been allowed to continue. And there are multiple instances from President Eisenhower through President Bush Sr. to, I could go on and on and on.
Reagan
with the phone call to Begin. Kissinger and Nixon and Ford forcing Israel into disengagement agreements. They kicked, they screamed, they fought. And the Americans said to them, we don't care what you say. We're going to win the Cold War. We win Egypt. We don't care about you. We defeat the Soviets in the Middle East. Israel is small change. We don't care. You will do what we say. So when selling arms to Saudi Arabia, I could go on and on and on. So it's absolutely not true that where what are perceived in Washington as vital interests are at stake, money, oil, winning the Cold War, whatever it may be, not fighting a war with Iran, American presidents have no compunction or have had. I mean, this one might be an exception in Trump, but with those two possible exceptions, American presidents have had no compunctions, no compunction about telling the Israelis to get off, you know, where to get off. So I disagree with the Mearsheimer thesis in that respect. However, he's right about one thing. Where Palestine is concerned, no vital American interests are perceived to be at stake. There are jackboot military dictatorships and the most absolute monarchies since Louis XIV who are completely under the American thumb. They will keep the people down. We don't care, therefore, about the Arabs because we have Arab regimes that are more American and Israeli than they are Arab. And so in Washington, there's no negative impact from blanket support for Israel where Palestine is concerned. Where critical American interests are concerned, as these people perceive them, they'll stop the Israelis cold. Right. And they have done it again and again. I'm not sure about this fellow,
yeah.
Biden. In fact, I'm pretty sure he wouldn't and hasn't. I think this has gone beyond the point of harming American interests. I think it's done irreparable damage to the United States. And I don't think this president sees that.
Fingers crossed. I mean, to the elites, not to the people, obviously. So shifting gears a little bit, in a recent interview, in that recent same interview with Tariq Ali, you said that for all their acumen in other respects, the leaders who organized this October 7th assault have what I would call tunnel vision. Okay. Very good unintentional pun, perhaps.
Intentional.
Okay. And what did you mean by that?
The leaders who decided on this, there were three or four of them, basically, as far as we know, we don't really know, but apparently Sinwar, Mohammed Daif, what's his name, Isa, three or four of the military commanders in Gaza decided on, devised, and I gather informed to some extent the Hamas leadership and vaguely informed some of their allies. They expected that the entire Middle East would rise up. And that's what I mean by tunnel vision. They are people who are basically graduates of one school, and that was the school of Israeli prison torture. Sinwar spent 23 years in an Israeli prison. He knew Israel better than most Israelis, but he knew it from the point of view of someone who had been tortured and held for 23 years of his life, most of his life up to that point, in Israeli prisons. And so they had a very narrow, and in my view, very limited view of Israel. And they were not like the Hamas leadership outside, who had traveled in the Arab world, who had lived abroad. Sinwar never lived abroad, nor did his brother, who's apparently still alive, nor had Mohammed Daif, who's dead, and the other guy. I'm forgetting his name. And so they had a very narrow, you know, Gaza is a place with some of the most gifted people in the world, open to the rest of the world. Every time I see a Gazan, they speak such perfect English. And I say to myself, these are people who have never left this prison. They were born in it, they never left it, and they're media savvy, and they speak English, and they write poetry, and so on. The leadership, the military leadership of Hamas was not in that category. They were not busy studying Blake and Shakespeare or listening to the BBC. They had learned in a very hard school, the hardest possible school, and they survived. And that's why I taught. And they built this tunnel network, this extraordinary. I mean, people are going to study what they did in military colleges for generations. Leave aside whatever atrocities may have been committed. Leave aside the horrible result of it all. As a military operation, it's extraordinary. But they were entirely focused on that. They couldn't see, for example, that under no circumstances would Iran go to war to support them. Under no circumstances. They won't now, and they wouldn't then. That's what I mean by tunnel vision. Or that Hezbollah would not act on their behalf rather than on its own behalf. I mean, anybody who knew Lebanese politics, like some Hamas leaders who lived in Lebanon, could have told them that. But they never left Gaza. In their minds, they never left prison, in my view. And so it, that, I mean, I didn't lay it out in the interview with Tari Ali, but I mean, that's what I meant. It was an intended pun, but it was meant to talk about a very narrow and limited view. I also think that you could argue, this is worth arguing at another time and in greater depth, but what their strategic aim was. I still haven't quite figured that out, but let's leave that.
Okay. Too big of a, it's a huge discussion. I was shocked by Sinwar's analysis of racism. I heard him comparing anti-Palestinian racism to the racism that killed George Floyd. Mm. And I was very struck by him. And speaking of Israel being, I mean, they have Hasbara, but I think they also produce anti-Hasbara because their release of the footage of Sinwar's death was, I mean, did they realize what they were doing?
Obviously not.
I mean, it's turned so many people, I think, into obviously supporters
not. It's turned him into a hero.
Yeah.
I mean, they're going to be talking about this for generations.
Yeah.
I don't understand what they thought they were doing.
I think it's their blind. I mean, I think it's just like tunnel vision. It's their contempt for these people.
Let's talk about Hasbara for a minute, because one of the things that I've always argued, and anybody I think can see, is that this was a prime weapon in the arsenal of Zionism, and it was wielded, in my view, brilliantly, through films. I mean, anybody over 50 who hasn't seen the film Exodus, raise your hand. Nobody. There are not many people over 50, maybe, but still. If you had an audience of people over 50 or 60, everybody would have raised their hand. I mean, that's the most brilliant propaganda ever. I mean, it's better propaganda than the Bible itself, in some respects.
More engaging.
Well, absolutely. Paul Newman, for God's sakes. Two Academy Awards. What can I say? And that has ceased to be the case. I noticed this myself. You used to have people who would challenge you or challenge me every time I opened my mouth publicly. That ceased about 15 or 20 years ago. There seems to have been a growing tendency to appeal only to the passionately converted to the particular right-wing vision that has dominated Israeli governments since 1977, basically. And that applies both inside Israel, where it's been extremely successful. I mean, Israel is united behind a vision which most Zionists in the United States would find abhorrent. But it has also limited their Hasbara abroad. Nobody believes it anymore. It's exactly what you said. It's counterproductive. And that's a result, I think, of a turning in on themselves by the Israeli right and their success domestically. So I think this footage was intended to play to the peanut gallery in Israel and to the people in the United States who support Israel, whatever it does. Ah, we killed him. And they had no sense. I'm sure there were Middle East experts, the kind of people who are concocting Israel's increasingly extensive propaganda directed at the Arab world, who probably tried to tell them don't do it. I don't know. I have no idea. But it was one of the greatest own goals in modern history.
Yeah. And then, I mean, I don't know if this went through a lot of people's heads, but it made me think of the Mahmoud Darwish poem, "Your arm fell off, pick it up and hit your enemy with it. There's no way out."
That's really interesting. I never thought of that. Wow.
Yeah. "And I fell next to you, so pick me up and slam your foe with me, for you are now free, free and free."
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm going to ask one more question, then we open it up. Okay, great. Returning to your family's connection to Palestine, a house that has been in your family since the 18th century.
Probably earlier, but we're pretty sure about the 18th century because we have some deeds from the 18th century.
Which you had intended to turn into an extension of the Khalidi family library.
We are doing that.
You're doing that. Okay.
Yeah.
You are doing that. Good. But a group of terrorist settlers has stormed it. What is the status with that?
They were expelled a few days later.
Oh, great.
It's back under our possession, under our control. There are still...
Minor victims.
Thank you. Yeah. There are still legal cases unfolding in the Israeli courts, and you can never tell what will happen in an Israeli court. But we're going ahead with the project to renovate it and turn it into a further extension of the family library.
Oh, great. Wow. Okay. Well... One more question then for me, then we'll take questions. But you said that you're retiring from Columbia, and in a recent— And in a recent Guardian, And in a recent Guardian article, you said, "I didn't want to be a cog in that machine anymore. For some time now, I have been both disgusted and horrified by the way higher education has developed into a cash register, essentially a money-making MBA, lawyer-run hedge fund, come real estate operation with a minor sideline in education where money has determined everything, where respect for pedagogy is at a minimum."
That represents my views.
Yeah. So can you talk about how this development of kind of the business of education has allowed for the crackdown on free speech and academic freedom that we've seen on campuses in response to the encampments, but also in response to just professors?
Right. I mean, first of all, I didn't resign in protest at what Columbia did this last year. I had planned to retire 3 years ago.
Just pretend you did.
No. I'm
just kidding.
But I retired partly because I didn't want to be, as I said in that interview with, I think that's the Chronicle of Higher Education interview.
Guardian.
The Guardian? Yeah. Well, I said something. I was quoted in the Chronicle interview as saying that. I wanted to retire because I couldn't stand the way the universities were, this university and universities in general, are being run. They're being run by people, as that quote indicates, who have no interest in or knowledge of education. Maybe some of them were educated. I don't know. But, and if they were educated, they were probably mainly educated in professional schools or as accountants or as MBAs. And I have no disrespect for accountants. One of my best friends is an accountant. I know many people who have business degrees. But they are cultivated, intelligent, civilized people. These people are not. These people are barbarians. These people only care about the bottom line. These people are expanding Columbia's real estate empire. It is now the largest real estate owner in the city of New York. The archdiocese has gone down for reasons you can imagine as an owner of real estate. And so now it's basically Columbia and NYU without any regard for the people of the neighborhood. And they've, you know, they have this vast, enormous hedge fund slash endowment. And that seems to be all they care about. And they constantly have been telling us, ever since I had administrative responsibilities, I was chair of the history department, I was director of the Middle East Institute, "We don't have any money." What do you mean you don't have any money? You own a quarter of Upper Manhattan. You have $15 billion in your portfolio. And you don't have money to pay for our graduate students who teach half of our courses or of our large lecture courses? I mean, this infuriated me. I just could not deal with people who talked in this fashion. And it continues to this day. I after I retired, I was talking to an old buddy of mine who's the current chair, and he described a meeting with the deans and the vice president. They're still on the same track. Cut PhDs. Why? Well, the union is demanding too much money. They do all the work, for God's sakes. They're the ones who bring in the undergraduate fees that pay your inflated salaries. And they don't see that. They don't care. It's all the bottom line. So that is an indication of who's really running the university. It's not the people who are supposedly scholars and academics, who are the deans and the vice presidents. It's the trustees and the money people in Low Library and in the administration building. And we saw that during the protests. Essentially, people who are responsive to what that vast elite believes, which is Israel can do no wrong, and anybody who opposes it and says anything critical of Israel or of Zionism is an anti-Semite. They own and run the university. I mean, they are actually the fiduciaries who own it. The Harvard Corporation, the Yale Corporation, the Columbia Board of Trustees technically own these places. But they showed that the owner does what the owner wants. And the owner does not want people protesting against the genocide. And they shut the place down. So, I mean, that was an illustration in the most horrible possible form over the past year of what I had been feeling over many years and what actually led me to begin 3 years ago to begin the path towards retirement.
Those outside agitators, as Mayor Adams called
outside
them.
Agitators with New York Police Department.
Yeah, exactly. They were describing themselves. It was a Freudian slip. Yeah. Well, let's open it up to some questions. Someone from JVP is going to walk around with the mic. And then I will sneak in some more. But I, of course, have more. But And by the way, I see people filming, which is great, but this will be on at youtube.com/The Katie Halper Show. So if anyone wants to watch the whole thing, it'll also be on WBAI in a few. I don't exactly know when, because it's WBAI.
When will it go up?
It's on. It's up now, and you'll be able to watch it later. So it's live streaming, and it'll be up.
So I should have brought my Brooklyn Dodgers hat to annoy all the Yankee fans.
Oh, yeah, yeah. True. I should have told you that. My bad.
Thank you both for the comments, and thanks to the organizers as well. A book that I often recommend to people after, if they like your book, is Avi Shlaim's new memoir, Memories of an Arab Jew. I was wondering if, because it's told in a similar way as a senior academic now telling his family history with a regional history. And I was wondering, common talking point is, around that history of expulsion of Jewish people from the Arab world, and how you, what's your view of the historiography now on that question? Thank you.
Right. That's a really great book. What's the title? Do you remember? Avi Shlaim. Three Worlds, bravo.
Yeah.
Three Worlds, colon, right. Memoirs of an Arab Jew. I'm actually teaching that book this year. I have such great admiration for the book and for Avi. I'll answer your question. Just let me describe the book for people very briefly. It's about his life in three worlds. He grows up as a member of a prosperous Baghdad Jewish family. They're forced to leave in the early 50s. He goes to Israel. He describes his life there as a Mizrahi, as an Iraqi Jew. This is a relatively comfortable, deeply rooted, thousands of years probably in Iraq, community that felt utterly at home in Iraq. And they're uprooted, and in Israel, they're treated poorly. I won't go into any more detail. And then he ends up in England. So those are the three worlds. It's a wonderful memoir. And it's both historically, it's a better way to tell the story of what happened to these communities than some of the histories. I've supervised dissertations on Yemeni Jews. I know the academic literature. And this is a better introduction to that, in my view, than the very good work that some of my own students have done. And the literature is actually getting better and better on Middle Eastern Jewish communities. There was a slight tendency in some parts of the literature to be propagandistic, and that has diminished over time, as I think people have taken charge of their own narrative. And you have a description by Yemenis and a description by Moroccans, who are now Israelis, of what actually happened, rather than a propagandistic. So the literature is getting better and better. It's a field that probably should grow over time. There's nobody who teaches that at Columbia, the history of Middle Eastern Jewish communities. And that's a third or half of the Israeli population are descended from Middle Eastern Jewish communities, Mizrahi communities.
Right. I have a friend who's Egyptian. She's, Muslim, secular. And she is always saying to me, I want my Jews back. I want my Jews back.
Sounds so funny.
Hi.
Thank you, first of all,
for this talk. So I wanted to ask two questions. The first was about, it's kind of like more methodological one, about the research you had to do with the book you mentioned. You had to go to Israeli archives. And yeah, I just wanted to ask about that experience, because I know from my personal experience that it's really hard. There's very much censorship about
the Israeli archives.
Yeah. And the other point I wanted to make, which you did, and I think it's really important, because about the Zionist project as a settler colonial project, European settler colonial project, because it's very important, because I always say it and I'll repeat it. Jewish communities in Arab and Muslim countries lived in harmony with their neighbors. We did not have the Jewish questions in Muslim countries. Especially in regards to Meir, I call her Meir, that's her real name.
Meyerson.
Called American settler. Yeah.
Yeah.
And her
dehumanization. She was born in Russia. Came to Milwaukee when she was a kid.
Exactly. But American. Russian. But in terms of her attitude and her dehumanization towards Palestinians. I wrote about it. She's very much American.
Thank you. Thank you. I mean, about the second part of your question, it's not a question I agree with you completely. And that the European aspect you can see in Herzl's writings. I mean, he says we're going to be a rampart for Europe against the barbarism of Asia. And it was seen that way by the Brits. So a British colonial official, I think, neatly summarized the settler colonial nature of the project as the British saw it. He said, what we're doing is we're creating a little Jewish Ulster in a sea of Arab barbarism or Arab something. I forget the exact wording. So I think both from the point of view of Herzl and the almost entirely European Jews who start the project and dominated the project until Begin, really, until 77. And from the point of view of the British. And I would argue it from the point of view of most of the people in Washington, to be very frank. I mean, to them, an Israeli life has meaning. And the president talks about them with apparent, visible empathy. I was going to say apathy. Empathy.
If only.
And it, to him, Arab life doesn't count. It clearly, I mean, cockroaches are more important to this president than the tens and tens and tens of thousands of people who have been slaughtered in Gaza and the now over 27,000 people who've been slaughtered in Lebanon. So there's a continuation of that attitude. As far as the archives are concerned, I didn't work in the Israeli archives. I had people who did some research for me. The Herzl letter was found by a friend of mine. It was known, but he actually found the original and copied it for me. And I did research in Israeli sources. For example, Ariel Sharon sued Time magazine for libel. The secret annexes to the Sabra and Shatila report, the Kahane Commission report on the massacres in Sabra and Shatila, were obtained somehow by Time magazine. And I was given access to the Hebrew originals and to the English translations that Time had made. And the chapter on the 82 war includes a huge chunk about Sabra and Shatila that's taken from those Israeli, that those secret, they're still secret, the annexes. And the last thing I'll say about the archives is you have, what's the word, various categories of access. If you're Israeli, you can get certain things. If you have a certain kind of clearance, you can get more things. So I have students who've served as officers in the Israeli military, and they are able to get stuff that other Israelis can't get and that American Jews cannot get. And they can get things that Palestinian citizens of the state will never see. And then recently they've digitized everything. And in digitizing things, all of the materials that were released to the public in the 1980s and from which the Israeli revisionist historians changed the writing of 1948, those have disappeared. You cannot access most of that stuff anymore. So you cannot write the books that Avi wrote, Avi Shlaim wrote, or that Benny Morris wrote, or that Tom Segev wrote, or that Simcha Flapan wrote, or that Ilan Pape wrote in the 80s and 90s, because those documents are not available to anybody. I mean, unless you have the highest possible security clearance, in which case you're not a historian, you're a military officer or a security officer.
It's like backwards. I mean,
it's amazing.
With time moving forward and
talk to Israeli historians.
Democratization.
Talk to Israeli historians. It drives them crazy.
Wow. By the way, another before we get to the next question, I have to jump in and ask, and then we'll get to the other questions. But you, I know, have said publicly, including on my show, that you wouldn't vote for Joe Biden. Of course, you're in New York, so. What are your thoughts now that he's been replaced by Kamala Harris? And I know you don't have a crystal ball, but do you have any ideas about how different a Trump presidency would be from a Harris presidency vis-a-vis yeah. Palestine?
Yeah. First of all, any one of you who, like me, is registered in this state was disenfranchised by a bunch of old men wearing white wigs in the 18th century as a result of our backwards slaveholder-written constitution. We have no voice in the presidential election. People in red states and blue states, we don't count. And that's a disgrace. So my vote, your vote, anybody who's not registered in one of the battleground states does not have effectively doesn't have a vote in the presidential election. You know, we might as well go out and die. Doesn't matter. We don't count. So that's the first thing. So my vote doesn't count. Doesn't matter what I say in this presidential level. I think you can say two things about one thing about Trump and one thing about Harris. I see absolutely no reason to believe from anything she's said or done that Harris will do anything different from Biden. I don't think she had the same exact brainwashing he did. She's much younger than him. So her brainwashing was brainwashing light.
Better language.
Yeah.
Less offensive.
She's also more in touch. Right. You know, from the heights of the Democratic Party nomenclatura, she looks down and sees slightly more clearly than Biden, who barely can see. The people in the 20s, 30s, and 40s who make up the bulk of the Democratic Party's actual constituency. And she understands that they are very unhappy. The overwhelming majority of Democrats, if they had a choice, would stop the war yesterday. Overwhelming majority. And she knows that. But she's part of the nomenclatura, and I don't expect dramatic changes. Now, I know that Netanyahu expects changes if she is elected and is very worried about that. I don't care about Netanyahu. That's my reading. It'll be Joe Biden light, probably. Right. Trump, the thing about Trump, you have to say, whether it's about this or anything else, is he's utterly unpredictable. And he's probably losing it. So a lot depends. I don't know about that, but he seems to be a little bit. Then that's just an impression. But it is clear that if he decides to do something, he can do almost anything. And the people around him might try and stop him. But if you read what almost every single person who was around him during his first and hopefully only term in office said, they didn't have very much influence on him. Now, maybe he'll pick a bunch of complete nut jobs this time rather than the group that he had around him in his national security team. And they will go whichever way he goes. So I don't think you can predict anything. I don't think he wants the United States to be directly involved in a Middle Eastern war. I think that's pretty clear. But I think that's true of the entire American elite. I think they, in their stupid, slow way, have learned the lessons of Afghanistan and Iraq, that it's maybe not politically a very good thing for you as a politician to send a lot of Americans to be killed. In the mountains of Afghanistan or the deserts of Iraq or in Palestine or Iran or anywhere else. So I don't think he, or for that matter, Harris, will necessarily get us into a direct involvement in a ground war in which American troops would be involved. The United States is fighting in this war. And I don't think either would do much different, frankly.
Yeah. You don't have to answer this, but if you want to, who are you voting for?
I'm not going to answer that.
Are you going to vote?
I always vote.
Okay. I would say you're like, we have no power to vote. I would say the power we have is to vote with our consciences as not being in swing states. So, which will not be Harris for me or Trump. Okay.
Thank you so much.
I won't vote for either of them. Okay. That for sure.
Terry Randall, right? That Operation Rescue guy? Just kidding. Sorry.
I wanted to ask a little bit more about the tunnel vision concept that you were talking about, that Sinwar and other Hamas leadership having sort of this tunnel vision, having spent their lives in Gaza, and most of their education kind of happened in the prison. Dr. Finkelstein had also mentioned how they're sort of limited in their knowledge about the world. But what was it that they didn't know, or what more information did they need about the rest of the world to help them accomplish their goal as a resistance, or the goal of liberation that they couldn't have learned either in prison or in Gaza?
Right. I mean, I compare them to the leaders, several of whom are now dead, assassinated by Israel. Who were operating in Lebanon or in Turkey or in Qatar or in other places. And all of whom I think understood that, or did not have, let me put it this way, the expectation that the military leadership that planned and directed and decided on this had. Specifically that they would by what they did on October 7th, provoke a region-wide upheaval. They seem to have believed this. They believe that people Palestinians inside Israel, people in the West Bank, Hezbollah, the various militias allied with Iran and Hezbollah, and Iran would immediately start or very soon start a process that would lead to a regional war. And that has not happened. And I don't think that Ismail Haniyeh or Saleh Harouri, people who are now dead, would or could have believed any such thing. So that's the strategic element that I think is pretty clear. And I mean, I've heard many people talk about this who have direct knowledge. They really expected something like this. I mean, you read Mohammed, or you listen to Mohammed Leif's statement the morning of the 7th of October. He's filmed from behind in shadow, and he's speaking. I assume it's his voice. But you listen to that message, and it's very clear they expected something that was completely unrealistic. In my view, completely unrealistic, thinking about the world as I saw it on December 7th, and since then has been proven to be unrealistic. That has not happened. And I think that that's one element of what I'm talking about. I mean, in another sense, they had a fantastically acute understanding of Israel. But I think in many ways also limited. I could talk about that if you want.
Fascinating question, by the way. Do you want to take a couple and then, like, at a time?
Two at a time.
First of all, thank you both for the conversation, for your work. I am a PhD student at Rutgers University, so also thank you for shouting out PhD students. I got reported for demonizing Israel about a year ago for showing a video of the history of the Nakba in my class and then going over the typical, like, it was a class on media literacy, and I went over the stereotypes about Muslims, dehumanization of Palestinians, like killed versus like murdered, etc. So I got reported for that, and I just was wondering if you have any advice for us PhD students who want to teach about the genocide, we want to teach about the struggle against the apartheid, but we are also at the bottom of the food chain,
right,
and we stand the most to lose. So if you have any advice to us.
Yeah, I mean, PhD students, PhD students, contingent faculty, the people who are doing most of the teaching at these hedge fund universities, and staff are the most vulnerable. Students are less vulnerable, strangely enough, undergraduates. But PhD students and people who are just out of their PhDs, the postdocs and the contingent faculty who do most of the teaching, have absolutely no security and no protection. So my first piece of advice to you is to talk to Palestine Legal, who are overstretched beyond belief. If you have extra money to give, if you have a very high tax bill coming up in April of 2025 for the 2024 tax year, please send money to Palestine Legal. They need it very badly because people like you are in their hundreds calling on them for advice, because this is happening all across the country at community colleges, small liberal arts schools, state universities, the most prestigious private universities. And it's happening in the dark. It's not publicized. It does not get into the New York Times or the New York War Crimes, as it should be called. So that's the second piece of advice is, what should I say? Be careful in what you say. I mean, I used to try and tell that to my PhD students. None of them ever listened to me. They did whatever they wanted, and that's fine. But then I didn't listen to my mentors when I was a graduate student. I went off and did things that, you know, in hindsight don't seem so wise. But, you know, but do try and be careful. Be sure of your sources. Be sure of your facts. People have said things that were frankly way over the top and were unwise. I'm not talking about anybody in particular, but that's the case. And then they came running to us as faculty, help us. Well, you never listened to our advice to begin with. And I mean, you know, we'll do what we can. We do what we can. And I'm sure Palestine Legal and others that you will go to for legal advice will do absolutely everything they can. Try and make their job easier if you can. I mean, stick to your principles by all means. But do that as wisely as you can. And that means, I'm sure you did this, you know, if you showed a film on the Nakba, I'm sure you did some research so you knew that the facts were accurate. But you should do that. Be sure that you do that. That's not going to protect you everywhere. I know so many people who've lost tenure track jobs, people who didn't get postdocs, people who didn't get jobs at law firms. even though they were careful. But not being careful will definitely sink you.
Yeah, more Finkelstein at Muhlenberg in Pennsylvania. Tenured Jewish professor just got fired.
Right.
Muhlenberg, yeah.
Hello. I had a question about the description you had of the Vietnam War and the Iraq War as being these moments in which it took the American government 10 years to really realize that the war was no longer feasible for them and them to eventually back out. And I was just curious about the granularity within that and what was it in each of those moments, the Vietnam War and the Iraq War, that you could maybe point to and say this was the moment where America decided that it was no longer feasible for them to continue. And is there a through line? And is that something that we can look forward to maybe if we're embarking on something as large as a 10-year regime or moment right now?
Thank you, Professor and Katie, for this wonderful talk. I attended a talk that you gave with Ta-Nehisi Coates at Columbia back in November, I think it was.
Yeah.
And at that time,
it might have even been October.
Probably. And I think at that time, there was a lot of despair and disappointment. And then you had said that, listen, the majority of the world is with the Palestinians. The majority of Americans are with Palestinians. And that had given us a lot of hope. But unfortunately, as the lady in the introduction had said, that after years of protests, encampments, resistance work, talking to neighbors, colleagues, losing friendships, we still seem to be at square one. So what gives you hope? What gives you reason to believe that there is light at the end of the tunnel? No pun intended.
Good question. Good question. Two good questions. I'll answer the first first. I mean, I'm not a historian of the Vietnam War. I lived it in the sense I was a student in the 60s. And we protested against the war, like most students, motivated, of course, by the draft, but also by the horrors that we were seeing on American television. And I was involved in protesting against the Iraq War as well. And I haven't really studied. I'm not an American historian. I'm a historian of the Middle East. But I've looked at what I think changed people's views. And I can tell you that better for the Iraq War. It was really very soon after Bush was reelected in 2004 that somehow, in spite of the military's absolutely tight censorship, the reality of the fact that this was going to go on for quite a while, that this was not a walk in the park like the 1990-91 war that Bush Sr. fought, that this was going to be a meat grinder war, it sank into public opinion. And that didn't directly affect the elites. What affected the elites was that the politicians realized that they could not be reelected if people had turned against this. And it became a political issue. And you saw that with Barack Obama early on in his campaign at the end of the Bush term, campaigning against war in Iraq. And he had sensed what politicians, smart politicians, were sensing. Wars in the Middle East are not popular. Wars where the United States has troops on the ground in the Middle East are not popular. And the factors that I talked about supporting this one, the military industrial complex, all of those things, those were still operating. They were making out like bandits. They were happy to have the war go on forever. But it became politically unfeasible. And just to answer, to finish answering that question, I'm not sure where that moment comes here. I don't know. I can't predict where that moment comes. Some of it in Vietnam had to do with horrific images. My Lai, pictures of children fleeing napalm, naked children fleeing napalm. That image that's indelible in people's minds of my generation. I'm not sure what the parallel in Iraq was. I don't think there were those images because the army has the military has rigorously censored coverage from the battlefield. You're either embedded and say what we want, or you can't report.
Maybe Abu Ghraib.
You may be right, actually. Yeah, could have been. That's very close to it. It happened in 82, by the way, in the Israeli war, because the Israelis didn't control the battlefield in terms of access. And most of the reporters were in West Beirut. And so they could see exactly what Israel was doing. They would bring down whole buildings. They would shell indiscriminately. And they reported that. Even Tom Friedman tried to report that when he was New York Times bureau chief. And what's his name? Was the editor? A.M. Rosenthal took it out. And there was a huge brouhaha about it. But the images were coming through. And that's what brought Reagan to call Begin on the 12th of August, 1982, and tell him it has to stop. This is a Holocaust. The image of this war is going to be a burned baby without arms. He had seen that picture, the president. So you can see where the images and the political, you know, considerations of these politicians coincided and helped to bring those wars to an end. The 82 war, the United States was fighting. I mean, the United States was involved in 82 as it was in 67, as it is in this war, directly involved. There were not American soldiers on the ground, but that's, you don't need soldiers on the ground when it's your planes and your money and your intelligence and so on and so forth. I don't know when it comes in this war, because we have a bifurcation between the elite, the gerontocracy that is our elite, the corporate owners, the media owners, the boards of trustees, the senior partners of the law firms, who wouldn't know the social media if it came up and bit them. And the younger part of our population, which only sees things through things like podcasts and Katie's and other people's non-traditional media. And so you have this bifurcation between the images that we all are seeing, or most of us are seeing, through social media and alternative media, and the complete blockage of any coverage, which is an American-Israeli conspiracy against us to prevent us from seeing what's actually happening in Gaza. Any news medium that had the slightest journalistic integrity would begin every report from Israel or Palestine by saying, we are prevented by the Israeli army from covering this. You do not see anything but what they want you to see. You are not seeing anything of the reality of this. Go to social media if you want to see it. Don't listen to us, CNN. Don't read the New York Times. They would say that if they had the slightest shred of journalistic integrity, which of course they don't, because their owners don't want them to have it, because their owners have no integrity. I'm sorry, that's another diatribe.
And they'd also probably speak out slightly about the fact that journalists are being targeted.
Not a word.
Yeah. Sorry.
Not a word.
Disgusting.
Not a single word. If enough white journalists are targeted, eventually they'll finally wake up. But it'll take a lot. It'll take a Pulitzer. Sorry, I hate to say this. It'll take a couple of Pulitzer Prize winners to wake them up.
Yeah.
Maybe, if that. To answer your question,
it's not the answer is not going to be traditional media for where you get hope.
Yeah, no, it's not. It's not. I think, you know, it's easy for me to say this because I've been in this business, whether it's the history business or it's the anti-war business, for most of my life. But these things really take time. And enormous amounts of suffering are going to occur before this thing can be stopped. I hope and pray that within the next weeks and months, couple of months, few weeks maybe, inshallah, it'll stop. But I don't think it necessarily will. I mean, this war could go on for quite a while. And you have to count on the same kind of things that I talked about when I answered the question about Iraq and Vietnam, that sooner or later, the drip, drip, drip of atrocity images will make its way up the age chain to the masters of the media and the masters of the, you know, I'm told that there are political advisors to Biden whose daughters slam the phone down when their fathers try and talk to them. I'm told that this happens quite frequently. Well, enough kids yelling at their parents who are in positions of power. Sooner or later, drip, drip, drip. I mean, it's terrible to think about this, that you have a country, the majority of whose population, Republicans and independents as well as Democrats, are not in favor of this war continuing and don't want to send weapons to Israel, and that we have to count on people's children to give them a conscience. But it's going to be that and political self-interest, a realization that you will lose your cherished political position if you espouse an unpopular war too long. Now, how long that will take, I don't know. The other thing is what I said about how what Israel and the United States are doing is shortening the life of this project. I mean, that's no solace if you have relatives who've been forced to leave Gaza. It's no solace if you have relatives in Beirut who are terrified every night because they're bombing the living hell out of the place. But it has to be some kind of solace that they are shooting themselves in the foot. They're killing a lot of people while they do it, but they're shooting themselves in the foot. And the global audience for Israel is gone. even the Western audience for Israel is diminishing with extraordinary rapidity. You look at England, four Labour Party seats that they couldn't have lost in a million years. They lost to anti-war politicians. Labour won an overwhelming majority, but four seats they didn't get because candidates campaigned on the basis of the Gaza war. Same thing in France. The party that won the largest numbers of seats in the Assemblée Nationale won it because they campaigned in the banlieue, and all of these French citizens, three generations, who happen to be considered issus de l'immigration because they're not white, voted and gave Mélenchon and the Insoumis the largest number of deputies in the French parliament. Well, those are signs of the fact that the West is turning. Public opinion is turning. England, France, the United States, and Germany is a little behind for its own peculiar reasons.
Jesus Christ.
But even Germany is beginning to turn. That doesn't give me any solace when I wake up in the morning and I look at the news from Beirut or from Gaza. But it's all we've got. And it in the long term, in the long run, or even maybe in the medium run, it means a great deal, I think.
I know that JVP wanted to say something. Esther Farmer, I believe, wanted to say something, so we want to give them the chance. I also think, by the way, one of those images is the people burning, being burned alive. I mean, I don't know. The thing about what's happening now is I have these rounds of like desensitization and then resensitization where I become numb. I don't think it can get any worse. And then you see something else. You see an image of a child's head open. You see the footage of someone being burned alive while attached to an IV drip. And it's like the rage that you feel towards the people that you know are enabling this. I mean, Biden saying that they were beheaded babies, not once, despite his staffers telling him it wasn't corroborated, not twice, but three times. The media talking about the rape while ignoring the alleged mass rape, while ignoring the documented rape that we've seen on the gang rape that was on video and the people protesting against the arrest of the rapists and the Knesset member saying it's legitimate to insert sticks into people's rectums. I mean, the silence on that is, it's just, the upside, I mean, the silver lining is it just exposes what the moral rot at the center of our political and media elites. But it's beyond disturbing and upsetting. Anyway, sorry, that was not the segue to introduce you.
That was the editorial department.
Yeah, that was right.
Well, we're coming to a close here, but first, let's show some love for these amazing presenters. We want to invite everyone to join Jewish Voice for Peace, JVP. It's very easy. Go to jvp.org/join, and you can become abreast of all of these amazing activities, political education, hard conversations, how to talk about Israel, Palestine, all kinds of incredible resources. So please join us. And thank you so much for that amazing interview. It was great.
Thanks so much. Anything that you want to announce, plug? I know you're working on a book about Ireland. Anything that...
I mean, Razia Iqbal did that profile of me in The Guardian. And she said, what are you working on? And I said, well, I'm beginning to work on a book on Ireland, Palestine, and Ireland and Palestine. And ever since that thing was published, I'm getting these emails from Irish scholars.
Oh, great.
And all my friends in Ireland saying, when's the book coming out? And I haven't been able to begin even really working. I've been researching it and starting to write it, but it's at the initial stages. I mean, anybody who thinks that they can get their head around Irish history, yeah, even a few decades of Irish history in a year or two, is out of their minds.
Yeah.
The Irish write a lot.
Yeah.
And they write well. And they know their history. And they love their history. And you got to read it all if you're going to, you know, I know enough about Palestinian history and I know a lot about the Brits. I've been looking at those things for my whole life. But Ireland, even though I knew about colonialism, I every time I open a book, I learn stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm still in the research and early writing phase. And I don't know when it'll be finished. If the war would end, it would help. And yeah. Until the war ends, I can't really focus. Right. I mean, how can you think about, it's not meant to be an academic book, but it has a core of research that unlike the Hundred Years' War, I'd been doing research on these topics for decades. I just started this like a few years ago, this Irish Odyssey. Yeah. So it's going to take a while. Well, but I love the topic.
Yeah.
I mean, I could talk all night about some of the stuff that I've learned, but that's another, and that's another session with you, Katie.
Yes, I love that. I think that's it, right? I want to thank the People's Forum, Rashid Khalidi, Roz, Sarah, JVP. Let me see. Oh, yeah. And also, very short, quick plug, go to youtube.com/The Katie Halper Show. No, it's free. You can subscribe there to catch more interviews like this. Although this is obviously one of a kind, but.
I want to say two words, one about JVP. I mean, I have dealt with and worked with people who are involved in this issue for my whole, the American part of my life. And JVP is by far the most serious and professional and dedicated and clear-minded group on the scene. I mean, I cannot say enough. Watching the actions that they've just done in New York City, I mean, I want to get down on my knees and, you know, thank them. So that's the first thing. Second thing, I am so happy to be doing this at the People's Forum, it's wonderful to be in a progressive space, and People's Forum has provided, as Roz said at the beginning, a sort of home away from home for us. But I feel particularly at home here because they came and took about 1,000 of my books when I had to leave my office when I retired, and they're on the shelves, some of them here. So I really feel at home, and so you should all feel at home. And this is a wonderful, wonderful space, and they're wonderful folks. So they deserve a big round of applause.
They name their stuff after people, like they have the Paul Robeson Cinema, so they should have like the Khalidi Library. Yeah. Well, thank you guys all so much, and have a great night, and keep the faith and keep the hope.